Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
And it's another interesting week, and we've got some great guests dropping by for interviews. Dev Patel and Jordan Peele will be talking about Monkey Man, and then we're going to be reviewing that film and also new horror, The First Omen, Netflix's Scoop, which tells a story of Prince Andrew's Newsnight interview, plus World Cinema releases Io Capitano and Evil Does Not Exist. But first, James, have you been watching anything else this week other than these films, or have you been to any events this week?
Ahead of The First Omen, I wanted to kind of refresh my knowledge of the Omen series. So I watched the first three, which are kind of films I remember being around when I was a child. I remember people at school were all talking about Damien, and it was kind of one of those movies that you had to sort of see, even though, of course, it wasn't appropriate for, you know, under 18s, let's say. Yeah, I remember seeing all of them when I was a kid. And yeah, it was interesting to kind of watch those first three again, especially in light of The First Omen.
I don't know if anyone else had this experience, but I sort of first became aware of The Omen through Only Fools and Horses, Del Boy's son, Damien, and Rodney's kind of fears about him. And I saw the film years ago. And so similar to you, I actually revisited, slightly confusingly titled the new film, but I actually revisited, let's call it The Original Omen, this week to kind of refresh myself ahead of the film. So I hadn't seen it in years. So that was interesting. And it's, I don't know how you found, James, but it is one of those films that has dated a bit, but I still found it quite enjoyable. And it kind of took me back. But I don't think it's sort of aged quite as well as some of the classic horrors.
I know what you mean. It's sort of chilling more than it is really scary, the original Omen, as we'll call it. It struck me kind of while watching it, and indeed the two immediate sequels, how different horror films are now to back then. They weren't reliant on constant scares and all of that stuff. It was much more kind of character driven, which I think to its credit, really, although all three of them contain some quite gory deaths, which I think are kind of the hallmark of that series. But yeah, you're right. It probably hasn't aged brilliantly. But then again, what a cast in the first one. Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, Patrick Troughton, you know, who obviously had gone on from playing the second Doctor Who, Billy Whitelaw, Leo McKern, who everyone knows as Rumpole of the Bailey. I mean, that's a hell of a British cast, or a British and American cast. So, and of course, Richard Donner directing the original as well before he made the original Superman. So that was the movie that broke him, I think.
Kind of a reminder of just what a sort of jack of all genres he kind of was, really. He was a real sort of like craftsman across the genres, wasn't he, Donner? Yeah, so kind of besides that, which and again, that is currently available on Disney Plus if you did fancy sort of checking it out ahead of the new film. That's where I was revisiting it. But the only other thing I've been watching really this week is I'm always notoriously behind on TV, and I've just started watching The Bear, which so many people whose opinion I respect, such as Jamie and Jordan from Total Film, love this series. So I felt like I would like it, but it was one of those ones that from the first episode, I was just like, oh, I'm going to love this. I can see why everyone rates it so highly. But I'm just catching up on that. So that's been
how far are you through it?
I'm literally two episodes in.
I can't remember which episode it is in the first season. It's like number six or seven. But there's one, I think it's the shortest episode of the series. And yet it's the one where your heart rate will just be going bang, 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 bang. I mean, the whole show is intense, but that episode is the most intense. So be prepared for that episode.
I'll look out for that. And I do like the fact it's short episodes. That makes it very inviting to me, because I don't think TV episodes need to be more than half an hour, to be honest. That's my controversial opinion on TV. But there you go.
It works well for that show, I think, because I think if you had an hour of that intensity, it probably would be too much to bear. Too much to bear, as it were.
On to new releases now. And first up, Dev Patel is turning director and action star in this.
When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me a story of a demon king and his army. They brought fire and terror to the land. Until they faced the protector of the people. The white monkey.
There you are. You are a beast.
This is Monkey Man, the directorial debut of Dev Patel, who also came up with the story and co-wrote the film. And he also stars as Kid, a young man who's on a roaring rampage of revenge in a fictional Indian city. It is a full-on action film. And before we review this, I recently spoke to Dev Patel and producer Jordan Peele, and here's what they had to say.
Every day, I've prayed for a way to protect the weak.
I've got an answer to every prayer. I call on Nikki.
Minaj.
Big bumper.
Nice headlights.
Let's boogie.
Monkey Man, it feels like a film that would be tough for like an actor or a director. So what made you want to kind of go so fully in on this as your sort of first directing feature?
This masochistic streak of... I'm a huge fan of the genre, like as a consumer. And I guess I was just desperate for some sort of like different representation to begin with. You know, 10 years ago when I started writing this, the only kind of roles I'd be offered in a film like this would be the funny sidekick or the guy that hacks the mainframe or something, you know what I mean? So to be able to fill the screen with my culture, my history, my ancestry. Also, I'm kind of a product of two worlds. I grew up born and raised here in the UK. So I just wanted to create a film that is kind of representative of like what I want the future of the genre to look like.
You've obviously both kind of, in a sense, moved from acting into directing. Like, why do you think so many actors do end up making that transition?
Actors get a real front seat to directing. You know, in the case of Dev and Monkey Man, it's quite clear that, you know, this is somebody, though it's his first film, it doesn't feel like his first film. And part of the reason is he's been working with some of the best directors on the planet and knows that process that, you know, one has to have with an actor and their crew. It's hard to get reps like that. But then it also, you know, you can't just be an actor. You've got to be a certain actor that's watching from the very beginning every single part of the process the entire way. And so that's clearly what he's done.
And did anything surprise you, Dev, about when you actually kind of, you know, got into the director's seat? Anything that was different about it to how you anticipated?
Every day we would face kind of catastrophe on this set. You know, it was kind of like one of those productions where I was like, you know, what could possibly go wrong now? And then like another 12 things that were just career ending would happen. And you're like, how do you... It was having a crazy, crazily precise plan that you're willing to throw out the window on a dime every day and pivot. And I think coming from acting, you know, that instinctual part of myself was what I relied on the most. Yeah. Being able to pivot and change. And, yeah.
And don't you find that the pivots often will like bring about your best, your favorite choices?
Always. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I think obstacles actually provide the best opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And Jordan, were there any sort of lessons you learned on Get Out, your directorial debut, that you kind of imparted to Dev at all along the way?
Well, first of all, when Dev first showed me the film, I think he was like, help. And, first I wanted to just reassure him, like, look, you are at essentially the same place that I've been at this point with all my films, which I think may have been a nice leveling thing. But, you know, then in the post process, you know, I just really wanted to impress on Dev that, you know, as far as Monkey Paw Productions was concerned, we really needed to get the film that he wanted to make, and that he could really, we would give him the tools, we would give him all of the advice we have, and that it was his job that we would honor to figure out what was the right advice to take. And he did that every step of the way.
And can you talk a bit, Dev, about your influences on this film? Because I know a lot of Korean films kind of inspired you, is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm a huge fan of, like, you know, everyone, the main comparison right now is John Wick, and I'm a huge fan of Chad as an individual, as a filmmaker and the franchise. But, you know, the OG guys that wore the brooding men wearing the suits and doing that amazing action were the Korean auteurs, and everything from Old Boy to Man from Nowhere to A Bittersweet Life to I Saw the Devil. Like, you know, these Korean films, not only do they have the most, like, violent, gory moments in action that you've seen, but they have a lot of emotion and pathos to them. You know, they're not afraid to double, triple down on these kind of emotional beats and lingering looks of love or longing or whatever. And for me, I really like that. You know, there's deep social context in these films. And yeah, I wanted to try and do that in my way anyway.
Kind of, this was originally set to be a streaming film, wasn't it? Before, was that before you got involved, Jordan? And so I wondered, how did that change kind of come about?
Well, I don't know. It may have been sort of dead in the water in a certain way, but Dev came to us with the film and said, you know.
It wasn't a streaming film. It's kind of like a dead, stagnant pond.
Stagnant pond. Yeah. He came and showed it to us, and, you know, we instantly, you know, saw exactly what he was doing. I mean, it was very clear, and it was very clear that he had been on a very long and difficult journey with the film. I think maybe he just didn't realize how unbelievably awesome it was. When we got into the edit together, he made some decisions that really spoke and emphasized this idea that it's going to be a theatrical. Pieces of music that the whole audience's head is going to be bobbing, you know, and this kind of thing. The work he did with the sound, you know, to make a dynamic soundscape is very theatrically forward and stuff like this.
And as a producer, can you still have a lot of influence once you've reached that post-production phase? Kind of, you know, is there a lot of kind of you can do with the raw materials there? And in terms of you having an influence at that stage?
Well, everybody has influence and, you know, on the project. And it's Dev's sort of responsibility to choose what to take from who. As a producer, when I'm talking to Dev, I like to talk to Dev as giving my advice, but not as a producer, just as a human being, you know, telling him how my experience of watching what he puts forward is, just as an audience member. And that's all I can ultimately expect, is that he hears me as an audience member more than anything else.
And Dev, like, how did you actually find it directing yourself as well? Like, how much of a challenge is that?
It's really difficult, I think. I think for me, I'm not the most technical actor, so like it has to sit inside me, the character. And once it's like, once I find it, I can exist in that, you know. So the difficulty is like clicking in and out. And you know, I had never really embodied a performance with so much rage, I guess. My hat's off to these like kind of amazing action actors, because it's difficult. You're really, you can't play it safe in that genre. Like, you either look strange doing it, or it works because you have to fully commit 110%, you know, to those moves, the way you move, the looks you got to throw. And it's like, it's kind of can feel like the most hammy thing in the world, but you have to go in with absolute conviction. It had to feel real to an extent where like my body really took the toll of it, you know. Like, it's not doing an emotional scene where you're like, God, if I can bring tears to my eyes and, you know, have snot falling out of my right nostril, I've got it. This is like, what am I going to do to my body to try and make this work? And I did have a few hairy moments there.
And are you then just kind of like snapping straight out of that rage and running over to the monitors to kind of look at what you've got? Is that?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And I tried not to look at the monitors, because that's a big time waste. You really rely on your team. And we would spend a lot of time rehearsing, getting the camera moves right. Then I'd step in and would go. If I knew it was working, if I could feel it in my body, in my cells, we would call cut. I'd look over to, you know, the producers, the DP, and everyone's like, yeah, we all know there's a synergy there, you know.
Jordan, have you ever been tempted to direct yourself in any of your films?
I guess if I was Dev, I would. I think one of the great choices with Monkey Man is the casting. You know, in an actor, Dev is somebody I've always wanted to work with, much more than my own damn self. You know, he has one of these qualities that really is a kind of classic, iconic quality that very few have, where I think the audience relates to him, whether it's in a familial way or a romantic way, or I want to be that guy, or I am that guy. You know, he takes us along for the ride just because he's of the presence of his soul and his loveliness.
So that was Dev Patel and Jordan Peele talking about Monkey Man. This recently premiered at South by Southwest, sort of came a little bit out of nowhere, even though Dev's obviously been working on it for years. And as mentioned in that interview, there's sort of superficial comparisons have been made to the John Wick series, understandably many levels, because it is this violent one-man army revenge film full of kind of, you know, brutal action featuring a sort of anti-hero in a sharp suit. So it is kind of understandable to me why people did draw those comparisons. But there are things that really do mark it apart from the John Wick series as well, make it very different. I don't know how much to kind of say about this before we sort of dive into the review, because as with a lot of these films, it's kind of relatively slender in terms of plot.
Well, that's putting it mildly, I would say.
Sort of slender of plot, but big on action. So basically, you've got this revenge story of this character known as Kid, played by Dev Patel. And when we meet him, he's kind of in this sort of underground boxing circuit, and he wears this sort of monkey mask. And this kind of like mini sort of prologue at the beginning, we see him as a child, and he's learning the kind of story of Hanuman, who's like this sort of Hindu deity, and is somewhat inspired by this character. And then, yeah, we see him, and he's kind of basically getting beaten and pummeled in this underground fighting ring led by Sharlto Copley. From there, we eventually sort of learn more about Kid's backstory, what sort of leads him to sort of take revenge on the powers that be in this very corrupt sort of fictional Indian city. There's a lot of other kind of cultural aspects involved, like some of the people he sort of falls in with and teams up with. And he basically goes on this big, violent rampage of revenge. And then from there, it is a really kind of full-on action experience. But did you like this film, James?
Well, it's interesting you say that people have compared it to John Wick, because I couldn't not compare it to John Wick. It's, if you had to put it into four words, it's John Wick in India. That's not to say it wasn't enjoyable. First of all, given he's also starring in the lead as well, and that's no small task when you're directing your first film, he's created an incredibly stylish action film. I mean, there are some absolutely beautiful shots in this, as well as some incredible action. If you just want to see a plain and simple action movie with some incredible fights, this is definitely the film to go and see this month. Obviously, there's no question about it. There's a scene, without giving anything away, towards the end, where a kind of lift opens and the main character, who's kind of, as you said, he's wearing this suit, very John Wick-esque, of course, in this kind of black suit, and he's bathed in this kind of red light. And I was just looking at that and going, and that's kind of, I think, being used on the poster as well, but or a version of that. And I was looking at that and going, wow, that's just such a fantastic image. And that was just one moment that stuck in my head. And yeah, so what Dev has achieved aesthetically with this film, along with his DP and his production designer, is remarkable, because he's obviously going to be working on a relatively slim budget. Obviously he's working with Jordan Peele here, but an interesting, I should add, that Peele stepped away from, everyone knows him for horror recently, and it's interesting that he's kind of aligned himself with more of an action movie here. So I thought that was quite interesting. But like you said, it's very, very slender as a story. I mean, arguably the John Wick films are slender too. I thought this was possibly even more slender than the John Wick films. At least in the case of those films, you have the whole world of the John Wick universe is set up, and it's kind of this bizarre hyper-real universe that's, where the law doesn't really invade, for example, and they all, run by these rules and regulations. There's kind of none of that here. It's really just a kind of, smash and grab action movie with a tiny reason for revenge, and not really as good as the dog in John Wick, which is really what kicked it all off in that franchise. But I thought it was an extremely enjoyable watch. If you just want to watch a kind of crazed action film, there are some fantastic fight sequences all the way through it. And you have to say, from a Dev Patel point of view, he's never played anything like this before. He's known for obviously things like Slumdog Millionaire and more, I suppose, heavyweight dramatic films, really. So to him to come out as an action hero, and he looks fantastic. He's obviously worked out really hard. He's worked really hard on the fight sequences, on the choreography. For him to do all of that, it's a real turnaround in his career. So there's lots and lots to admire about it. Story-wise, yeah, I thought it was a bit lacking.
Yeah, I perhaps liked it slightly more than you, in that I think if you kind of go in expecting it to be a slender story, as this kind of film often is, I sort of forgave it that. It's just kind of full on in every respect, because there's full on kind of brutal action, but even just the soundtrack is really kind of pumping, and the sort of style of the camera work, all kind of jagged and everything. I just thought it was a really, really sort of, like intense sort of cinema experience, left a bit breathless. Perhaps it doesn't like reinvent the wheel, really. Like I did like the kind of cultural elements that were brought to it as well. I thought that gave it a kind of an interesting dimension. But it doesn't reinvent the wheel of this kind of action film. I kind of appreciated it as just a grueling experience where you feel kind of a bit breathless afterwards. Like you say, I think it was obviously such an impressive feat from Dev, because I do genuinely think it would be impressive if he was either directing it or starring in it. But to do both, I just can't really quite get my head around how sort of knackering that must have been. especially, like you say, it's kind of very different for him, completely different kind of role. And kind of as a director, he just doesn't kind of pull any punches at all. And like, you just wouldn't think this was, feel that this was a first time director. Maybe the kind of slenderness of the story kind of makes you feel that, but that's the only thing really that possibly gives away that it's a debut. But considering, like you say, he's best known for these more kind of what you might call sensitive roles, he really kind of goes all out and doesn't kind of hold anything back when it comes to the sort of the violence and the action. So I thought it was just very impressively put together, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is super violent. And in a way, compared to the sort of cartoonish violence of the John Wick films, which kind of became more and more cartoonish as the films went on, this is much more gritty on some level. There's some quite nasty moments that had the audience that in the screening I was at kind of wincing and so on and so forth. So again, if you enjoy that, as you say, he doesn't pull any punches. You know, I should add, although I had reservations about the storyline, as you mentioned, the kind of cultural touchstones, setting it in India was great, because obviously the kind of films we're used to seeing in India are kind of Bollywood extravaganzas. This is nothing like that at all. You know, there's a sort of rickshaw chase at one point, which is really well done. I think the last time I can remember a rickshaw being used was Octopussy, the James Bond film. But that was really well done. So there was lots to like about it in this sort of this Indian setting. And I thought that worked really, really well. And then it certainly, Sholto, who you mentioned is this kind of organizer of these underground fights, he added real texture as well. I always enjoy seeing him pop up in films. He's got a real authenticity to him. So, you know, there was definitely lots and lots that I liked about it. I think I just came away going, I'd love to have seen a bit more substance, perhaps to the backstory.
So that is Monkey Man. And if you fancy seeing that, that is in cinemas from this Friday, the 5th of April. Next up, we're going back to the beginning with a horror origin story.
You don't have to be afraid. God has great plans for you. This child is his way.
There's this girl at the orphanage. I think that she really needs someone to look out for her.
Carlita
suffers from a touch of madness.
You must be very careful, Margaret. Bad things will start to happen around her. Evil things.
It's all for you. No, don't.
This is The First Omen, which is a prequel to Richard Donner's 1976 horror classic and is set in Rome, and it digs into the conspiracy to bring about the birth of the Antichrist. James, do you want to set this one up for us?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said a minute ago, it is a prequel to the original 1976 Richard Donner film, The Omen, and it's set in Rome, which is where the original Omen film begins. As you said, it's about a sort of conspiracy in the Catholic Church to bring about the birth of the Antichrist. We first meet a young nun who's come from America, played by Nell Tiger Free, and she sort of gradually gets sucked into this conspiracy. Ralph Ineson, who everyone, of course, always remembers as Finchy from The Office, although recently also seen in Gareth Edwards, The Creator. He plays Father Brennan, which, if you know your Omen lore, that character was played by Patrick Troughton in the original. So he's obviously a younger version of that character. And he's become aware of this conspiracy where there are sort of two sides of the church, let's say, the God-fearing side and then this kind of evil side that wants to bring out this Antichrist and control it, partly to sort of scare people back into the church in this kind of irreligious age that they now find themselves in. So really, we're kind of looking at, it's never very clear, I don't think, what exact year it is, unless I missed that, and maybe you saw it, but it was sort of, we're assuming early 70s.
Basically. I think it does say 71 early on, yeah.
Right, so yeah, I have to say, the texture, the look of Rome of the early 1970s was beautifully brought about, actually. I mean, I really felt like I parachuted into the middle of Rome with the kind of, not just the fashions, but the kind of slightly smoggy, smoky kind of atmosphere that they created. I really like that part of it. But but yeah, so really, it's this gradually Nell's character, Margaret, sort of does discover this kind of horrifying conspiracy, and it kind of gets scarier and scarier from there.
And so did you like this film?
I have to say I did. I mean, we've only just seen it a couple of hours ago, so it was kind of it's kind of fresh to us. But yeah, I kind of thought, well, especially as I've revisited, as I mentioned earlier, these earlier Omen films, and I have seen the 2006 remake of The Omen, which had Julia Stiles and Liev Schreiber in it, which was solid without being particularly remarkable. I would say this is probably the best Omen film I've seen since the original. It's really creepy in places. I really like the fact it has a female sort of led cast as well. I mean, around now, you've got Bill Nighy, who's playing a cardinal. As I mentioned, there's Ralph Ineson. Charles Dance pops up as another cleric as well. So it's a solid support cast around her, but she's really, really good in the lead. And there are some really creepy moments in this film, and I don't generally get scared by horror movies, but I was kind of looking at that going there's some grim moments. I don't even know if we want to reveal them. Perhaps benefit to let audiences find out themselves, but I don't really like spiders, and there's a couple of moments with spiders in it which, you know, creep me out. So that was one. But how did you find it?
Again, it's quite a full-on film, isn't it? And I often end up referring to like the BBFC certificates on this podcast. So apologies for anyone who that kind of bores. But this is a 15, and I think this is really at the higher end of 15. I was kind of surprised almost afterwards that it wasn't an 18 based on some of the stuff. And yeah, I felt very similarly to you, really, in that I really quite enjoyed this. And it's funny, it's very funny that it comes so hot on the heels after Immaculate. I feel this will go down as one of those, you know, the deep impact Armageddon type thing, where the two films are just released really close to each other. And they are so similar in a lot of respects, like a kind of, you know, an American nun in training kind of heads over to Italy, joins a sort of creepy convent where there's sort of weird conspiracies going on. And I enjoyed that film. And I'd put this on a similar level, really. They're slightly different, you know, in various ways. But I kind of enjoyed them both. And yeah, like you say, I thought this one, I really thought the production design was great, you know, in terms of the setting and everything. And then, yeah, there were some really sort of creepy moments. There were just some really striking visuals, some creepy jumps, some kind of disturbing, gory, body horror-y kind of elements to it. There was also some kind of stuff I thought was really well done that was kind of creepy, but just came down to acting, really, in terms of people pulling these like creepy smiles and, you know, getting a bit sort of unhinged and things like that, where it was all sort of down to the performance, but in quite an unsettling way. And a lot of it was well handled, I thought, in terms of like the way things are glimpsed, you know, and I liked the way the conspiracy sort of played out. I must admit, I wasn't entirely surprised by the way it ended up going, but that didn't really diminish my enjoyment, to be honest. And so it just was a kind of a world I sort of enjoyed being sort of, or enjoyed being a strange word, but, you know, a world that I sort of really felt like I was thrown into. Yeah, I thought it was just a really, really sort of solid horror film. I did think it benefited from having seen the original recently. You know, you could just take this on, you know, on its own terms if you've kind of coming fresh to the series. But I felt like it benefited having recently seen the original. So I'd say that's worth a revisit beforehand if you're not particularly familiar. But yeah, I just thought this was kind of like a really nicely done horror film.
Where I sort of had fault with it were there were a couple of moments where they are deliberately alluding to the first film. There's the famous line, "It's all for you," comes up again. I won't say how, so we won't spoil it for listeners. But and there was someone else's demise in the film that kind of reminded me of a death that happens in the second episode. Now, that may have been coincidental, whereas the first, the death I'm sort of referring to earlier with the "it's all for you" line is a deliberate nod to it. But the other one could have been coincidental, but it was kind of similar. So partly when it went too close to, you know, to make these kind of callbacks to the original franchise, that's where I found it slightly weakened, but it wasn't enough to sort of put off my enjoyment. What I kind of had a real problem with, though, is this, the basic concept that a sort of schism inside the church would create and think that they could control the Antichrist. It's like, why? I mean, you know, that's really asking for trouble, isn't it? But I didn't really buy that as a sort of an idea. But hey, if you go with that, you know, then fine, you'll probably enjoy the movie.
Yeah, again, it's a bit of that thing that you were saying about the first one being the sort of the talk of the playground almost, that you kind of know what you're getting yourself in for with an Omen film, don't you? And the kind of the mark of the beast and all that stuff. Like, again, which if you think about it too much, just feels a bit silly, that the sort of the 666. But I thought this film kind of, you know, like within those parameters delivered well, really. And I thought, again, not to just keep making immaculate comparisons, but I thought they were on a similar level. In some ways, there was something a bit bolder about Immaculate, I thought, and it sort of wasn't beholden to any sort of franchise. So in that sense, it felt a touch more original. But maybe here I enjoyed the way that the sort of the conspiracy element played out a bit more, and perhaps found the sort of scares a bit more effective here overall. There's sort of later in the film as well, we do kind of, again, there are a few more ties to the original, which that was something which for me kind of stretched it a bit, stretched the sort of enjoyment a little bit. But I sort of understand why they do it. And similar to your qualms earlier, I didn't think it was enough to, you know, derail the film. But yes, I just thought it was an interesting horror film. And the director, Arkasha Stevenson, I believe it's her feature debut. And I thought it was a very, very strong calling card, really.
Well, yeah, like Dev Patel's first film, it's, you can sort of go, the director has really thought hard about the look of the film. There are even certain scenes quite early on. I remember a scene where they go into a room and there's just kind of like a cigarette burning on an ashtray. And okay, that's not the world's greatest shot you've ever seen, but there was just sort of like the way I really like the framing of the film, and that particular moment, for some reason, again, it just sort of stuck with me. And I just felt like every scene had been really carefully thought about from a visual point of view. You know, there were some lovely moments very, and this isn't really giving anything away, very early on when a kind of stained glass window shatters and kind of the glass pours over the Charles Dance character, and he kind of just goes, "I'm fine." And you kind of go, he's protected by this presumably evil shroud around him. And there were like lovely moments like that that really, really worked. I thought it was a very effective horror movie. I haven't seen Immaculate, so I can't compare that yet. But I'm curious now to see it and to dig it out and sort of compare and contrast.
Yeah, just really, really interesting. They just came at such a similar time. But if you do fancy that, that is The First Omen, and it is in cinemas from Friday, the 5th of April. Next up is An Incredible Journey from director Matteo Garrone. So that is Io Capitano. James, can you set this one up for us, please?
Sure, absolutely. Well, as you said, this is an incredible journey. It's kind of based on, I don't think one specific true life story, but several journeys that were taken. It's another refugee story. This film was in Venice at the film festival last year, which is where I saw it. It picked up an award for Garrone. Garrone, of course, is the Italian director. People know him best for Gomorrah, the sort of Naples kind of gangster movie that ultimately spawned a TV series. This takes him a long way from home, although ultimately the destination is Italy. It's following two Senegalese cousins, Seydou, played by Seydou Sarr, and Moussa, played by Mustapha Fall. These guys are kind of non-professional actors who've come in to work with Garrone here. And these young lads decide to leave their home and head to Europe, as so many people decide to do, not really knowing the dangers that they're going to face. Initially, they go from Senegal into Mali on kind of fake Malian passports. They end up crossing the Sahara Desert. They end up in Libya at a certain point. And they're heading towards Italy. That is their destination. What they have to go through on this journey is, well, it's horrifying, basically. I don't want to say too much because it lessen the impact for anyone that decides to go and see it. It's interesting. I interviewed Garrone for this film, and he talked about, on some level, this is kind of a fairy tale or a fable, I suppose might be a better word. It's not as gritty as, say, we've got Agnieszka Holland's Green Border coming up, which was also in Venice, which is about Syrian refugees on the kind of Polish-Belarus border. That's probably more hard-hitting on some level. But this has its moments that will really shock you. Some of the narrative you could go, if it's possibly driven by coincidence, that perhaps lessens the impact of the film. But the two main guys, they have these kind of dreams of kind of music careers and things, and they're going to, you know, I think they're actually really, or at least one of them is a sort of TikTok music star in real life back in Senegal. You know, they have these dreams of kind of, you know, getting to Europe and kickstarting a kind of an amazing music sort of rap career or something. But, you know, they're obviously naive and they don't know the realities out there and the fact that people are on this journey are willing to exploit them and far, far worse. But, you know, despite this kind of slight fable-like quality to the story, I was really captivated by it when I saw it. It was one of those, I think I saw it at 8:30 in the morning, which is not really the time to watch a movie like this, but is often the case at festivals. And it was towards the end, I remember that, and being, you know, by that point, you're quite tired and you're sort of like, oh my God. Same with Green Border, actually. I saw that at 8:30 in the morning, quite near the end. And you're kind of like, oh, please don't, you know, subject me to these really tough, rough storylines. But yeah, it really did captivate me. And Seydou Sarr, who plays, you know, I mean, Seydou, the character, is really the main character in the film. He gives a really magnetic performance. I mean, they both do, but I think more of the focus from Garoni is on his character and what he goes through. And yeah, you will be shocked, I think, when you see it. It's interesting that, as I mentioned, Green Borders around, there are a couple of other, I suppose, refugee-driven stories that have come around recently. I mean, of course, this kind of thing's in the news all the time when you hear about boats coming to England and so on and so forth. And obviously, this stuff's going on in Europe as well. And it's interesting that several filmmakers are making these stories at the moment. And, I think they're really important stories to tell. Whether it is a sort of gritty, hard-hitting version like Green Border, or perhaps a slightly more fable-like version that Garoni, you know, Garoni is a director, unless we forget, who did A Tale of Tales, which was, you know, a genuine Italian fairy tale. And I think that's the kind of thing he gravitates towards. I'm not going to say what happens at the end, but it's up to you to decide whether it's a happy ending or not. But, you know, not all fairy tales have a happy ending. So while there might be a certain unreal quality to their journey, you know that people have made these journeys in real life. And as I said, it's based on several real life journeys. And, you know, so they're taking real stories. So personally, I would recommend it. I think it's an interesting film and it's an important film.
So if you like the sound of that, that is Io Capitano, and that is also in cinemas from this Friday, the 5th of April. Next up, it's a new film from the Japanese auteur behind Drive My Car.
汚染って言ったって都会の水よりずっと綺麗ですよ。グランピング場のエッジ、あそこは鹿の通り道なんだ。でも住民の方たちはバカじゃないですよ。クレイモードさんには今からやろうとしていることがそういう街の埃に触れる部分なんだっていうことを理解して。遅くなりました。今日もきっと忘れてるから歩いて帰るって。
This is Evil Does Not Exist. James, what is this one about?
So Evil Does Not Exist is by Risuki Hamaguchi, who is, as you say, a Japanese auteur, best known for Drive My Car, of course, which won the Oscar for Best International Feature a couple of years back. But he's been working for quite some time now, and his career has kind of been growing and growing. And this was an interesting project, just to give a bit of backstory, first of all, in that it began, I guess, as a piece of music, because the composer, Eiko Ishibashi, wanted Hamaguchi to score a kind of some visuals, I think it was, for a tour that she was going on. And he sort of did so. And then out of that grew this film, basically. And I think early on you'll see, it's all set in this kind of rural village in Japan, and you'll see lots of kind of footage of trees and the countryside. And I think that was kind of the visuals that he was scoring, you know, her tour to, if you see what I mean. And then kind of from that, he's built this story out. led by a character called Takumi, played by Hitoshi Omika, who is kind of an odd job handyman type around the village. He's a single father. People seem to like him. He's sort of well admired. Quite early on, for about the first 10 minutes or so, not much happens, but in a way of you just get to observe him going about his tasks in this forest, which is sort of beautiful, tranquil, rural part of Japan. And then gradually the sort of story comes into focus. There are a couple of people who've been employed by a Tokyo company who are basically, they bought a plot of land in the area and they're planning to sort of launch this kind of glamping site. And they're hosting a kind of what you call a town hall meeting to sort of, you know, get the locals on side. But there are various problems that the locals raise. So at that point, you think it's going to be a sort of environmental story, and it definitely has that theme to it, where you know this big corporation's coming in and they're trying to launch this glamping site, like I said, and you think it's going to be I suppose maybe the villagers against the corporation, and it has that element to it, but and I obviously can't go into what happens in the final third. It would be interesting. I think it was possibly either Variety or Hollywood Reporter. I'd have to check that, but I think it was the Variety review. It might have been the other one, but where the reviewer who'd seen it in Venice, which again, it was this film played in Venice, which is where I saw it. And he kind of said he woke up the next day thinking back to that last third and couldn't really believe what happened. And okay. I think he enjoyed the film, as I remember from the tone of this review. I was a little less struck, mainly because this final third just goes in a very strange way. Far too difficult to talk about without giving things away, but it's totally unexpected from what has gone before it. Let's put it that way. So I guess if you're prepared for a very strange ending, you might enjoy the general strangeness of this film. I mean, I guess maybe it could be seen as, I don't know, like an opera or something, in the way that the kind of dramatic music that you get. And the score is fantastic, by the way, by the composer. But it's a really weird last 20 minutes in what happens. You know, people are used to sort of Hamaguchi's films. I mean, Drive My Car was this sort of long 3-hour, I suppose, meditation on theatre and art. And it felt more unified than perhaps this film. This is much more out there. I think people will like it. I think I was sort of taken aback by the direction it went in. It didn't sit that easily with me. But I think he was quite, I remember we spoke to him in Venice and he was quite happy to leave the audiences confused, really. And that's good when a filmmaker does that. I always find that interesting. Didn't particularly like this, but it won a big prize in Venice. I think it was the Grand Jury Prize. That's basically like the Silver Lion, the second prize. Mm. So clearly the jury dug it. Yeah, it's definitely an experimental film. It's quite a risky film, perhaps riskier than some of the others he's done, although he has made 5-hour movies in the past. So I guess you'd call that risky. But yeah, that is Evil Does Not Exist.
So if you do like the sound of that and willing to give a kind of crazy final third a go, that is Evil Does Not Exist, which is also in cinemas from Friday, the 5th of April. And now for our final film of the week.
Everything's changed. The FBI are raiding Epstein's home. You can't stay silent. South drawing room, 2 chairs, 6 feet apart.
It's like a Western.
Make no mistake, if we don't get the tone right, the story won't be him. It'll be us.
Your Royal Highness.
Tomorrow night, in an unprecedented interview, we will hear from the Duke himself.
You know, I thought that all went very well.
All across the world, every paper, on every news channel, this is the story.
Go away!
This is only going to get bigger.
This interview, does it matter?
Yeah, it matters.
So this is Scoop, which is kind of a British Netflix movie based around the 2019 Newsnight interview between Prince Andrew and Emily Maitlis, based on a book by Sam McAllister, which is called Scoops, talking about how she sort of, you know, got pulled some of those interviews together. So it's very much like about how that interview came together, basically starting sort of almost a decade earlier with Prince Andrew being snapped with Jeffrey Epstein. And then we jump kind of forward in time to sort of the beleaguered Duke of York kind of finding himself in a position where he needs to kind of rehabilitate his public profile. And he's just kind of dogged by these accusations against Jeffrey Epstein, which kind of keep getting worse and more is coming out. Him and his team feel like they need to do something to, control this narrative. At the same time, we're following the character of Sam McAllister, who's played here by Billy Piper, and seeing how they basically went about trying to secure this, exclusive interview in the palace and, trying to get something newsworthy for Newsnight, how it worked in that sense. In terms of the casting, besides Billy Piper, you've got Gillian Anderson, who's playing sort of the journalist Emily Maitlis, and Rufus Sewell is kind of under pretty heavy prosthetics as Prince Andrew. Yeah, so basically that's the setup. It's the story of that interview. Did you like this film telling of that story, James?
Yeah, I did. I've been waiting to see this one for a long time. I followed the Epstein case very closely and, watched various, it was a Netflix documentary and there's been podcasts and things about various characters around that universe, let's say. So this one was always going to be a fascinating one. I mean, that interview was absolutely notorious with the sort of famed references to Pizza Express in Woking and the prince's inability to sweat. But I didn't know the backstory as to how that interview came about. So yeah, I was definitely looking forward to this. I think it's a really solid telling of that story. Interesting that it comes from the angle of the Newsnight team, obviously. There were a couple of things I was amazed by. I don't think there was a huge amount of new information in there. I think it's so well known, that interview now, that perhaps there couldn't really be. But there were some interesting things, like Princess Beatrice was present at the first meeting with Prince Andrew and the Newsnight team. That was quite an interesting aspect, which I didn't know. I didn't really know how the photograph came about, the one you referred to where he snapped with Epstein in Central Park. You have the sort of paparazzi guy played by Connor Swindells, who everyone knows from Sex Education. So there were little interesting snippets of information that came together. It's another of these, journalist stories, like Spotlight, I suppose, a film like that, where we get to see the inner workings of a news team. And I think it did that really, really well. I mean, I thought Gillian Anderson was absolutely fantastic as Emily Maitlis. She completely nailed her on-screen persona, that voice. She did that brilliantly. I mean, she's obviously an extremely talented actress, but I thought she really, really nailed this. Likewise, I thought Rufus Sewell was very, very good as Prince Andrew without it leaning too much into an impersonation. I mean, you could look at this as like a sort of an offshoot of The Crown or something, like the episode of The Crown that they dared not make, basically, where you get obviously shots inside the palace and you see the kind of workings of the inner workings of the royal family. I think one of the things I was amazed by was how Prince Andrew's sort of PR team, let's say, around him was so completely inept, basically. And it dramatizes this a little bit. You have one woman who's kind of pushing forward for this interview and then one sort of spin doctor who really doesn't want it. And yet, even though it's his job, he seems to just let it happen and then departs from the scene. And I was kind of like, my God, what a terrible, set of advisors he seemed to have around him. Everyone wanted to know about the Epstein, his friendship with Epstein, and it was so dangerous to let him go on camera with one of Newsnight's sort of premier interviewers, but that's what happened, and that's what the film shows. But no, I really did enjoy it. I thought it was a solid telling of the story without being particularly revelatory.
Yeah, I felt very similar, really, in that I do have a soft spot for these journalist stories, so I'm always going to kind of warm to that kind of thing. And you're seeing these teams, kind of how they work, how they research, having to kind of cross all the T's, dot all the I's. And there is just something, there's something I always find kind of stirring about, power being held to account and that kind of story. Like you say, nothing massively surprising, but a sort of a really, I just found it really entertaining, even without being massively surprised. And again, another sort of small qualm I had about it is I found the ending verged on anticlimactic, just because you basically know where it's going, so there's no kind of massive surprise to end on. But I still thought it's really satisfying, and I thought it did a good job of being one of those films where you basically know what happens, and of course you, I mean, the chance are you've seen the interview, and so you know it happens And so you know they are going to secure this interview. But I still thought they did a good job of kind of building up the tension leading up to that moment. There is a nice feeling of sort of being behind the scenes there as well. Even just the kind of getting everything and everyone into the palace was sort of interesting to me. Yeah, I just thought it was nicely done. And I like the performances as well. And I slightly, even with Gillian Anderson, who an actor I just really like, of course. But at first I found it a bit like, just because Emily Maitlis is sort of, you know, so recognisable as well. I was kind of like, I don't know if it's just a wig or a haircut is just enough. But then as it went on, I did actually think she did a really good job of kind of capturing her sort of mannerisms and tone. And kind of by the end of it, I was kind of really, really sort of swept up in that. So again, because this is one going to Netflix as well, I think if you sort of treat it as a TV drama in that sense, it really, really was kind of, yeah, I found it just sort of satisfying and enjoyable and interesting to just revisit that kind of wild story. The thing which I perhaps did find the most kind of revelatory and interesting, which I wasn't aware of, is that Prince Andrew and team seemed to think that the interview had gone well, which was one of the most mind-boggling things to me, really. But there you go.
And there was a lovely bit before the interview where they're both, the Maitlis character and Prince Andrew, are rehearsing their questions and answers.
Yes.
And it looks like they're actually doing the interview when, in fact, they're sitting opposite different people, not each other. I thought that was a really clever introduction into the interview because you know those are the big questions that are going to be asked. I thought that was a really smart piece of filmmaking. Yeah, that was kind of my favourite element of the film as a piece of direction, let's say.
Yeah, that was really nicely done. And so that is Scoop, which is on Netflix from Friday. So we're almost at the end, but James, what is your film of the week this week?
I will go for The First Omen, I think.
I'm really torn because for me, it's between The First Omen and Monkey Man. So I'll go for Monkey Man to balance out, but there's not much in it for me really in terms of kind of enjoyable cinema experiences. So we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Don't forget to check out the current issue of Total Film Magazine starring The Fall Guy. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others find us. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. Before we go, time for just a quick question. James, which of your interviews would you most like to see being turned into a film in the spirit of Scoop?
Well, the only one I could think of, only because it was just so Hollywood, was it was a round table interview Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in Cannes. It was the first time I'd ever interviewed Pitt, and Brad Pitt sat down with Leonardo DiCaprio, and I kind of looked at Brad Pitt and I thought, oh my God, that's true Hollywood right there. So I would somehow like to see that dramatized in a Hollywood movie.
If I had to pick one here, I'm going to go for one of my very first ones, which was an on-set interview for a completely random film with the late Bob Hoskins. And there was me, the kind of very green cub reporter, him, the sort of seasoned old actor, not willing to give sort of anything away, and me having just that first experience of when you're speaking to someone who just does not want to kind of play the game or give anything up, and suddenly realizing that your list of questions is nowhere near long enough and having to make it up on the hoof and sort of really, really try and coerce some answers out of them. That's probably the one that springs to mind for me with the most dramatic potential. But I still feel like that's a short film at best. That's like a 30-minute special at best, I'm afraid. But that's all from us this week. So thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
It's a boy. I'll tell you what. He won't be frightened to get changed in the showers. It's a boy.
Look like an angel, walk like an angel, talk like an angel, but I got wise. You're the devil in disguise, oh yes you are.